Join the Army and fight for your freedom. Our first stop is at a little college, and we is in a big auditorium up on the stage. Colonel Gooch get up and begin giving the speech I done supposed to have made. When he is through, he say, "And now we will have a few remarks from the latest Congressional Medal of Honor winner, PFC Forrest Gump." Some people are clapping, and when they stop, I lean forward and say, "Join the Army and fight for your freedom." I reckon they'd be expecting something more, but that's all I've been told to say, so I just stand there. Then somebody in the front shout out, "What do you think of the war?" And I say the first thing that comes into my mind, which is, "It is a bunch of shit." Next morning, we is in a hotel ready to give our second speech when the phone rings. When Colonel Gooch finally put it down, he'd be staring at his shoes. "Well, Gump, now you has done it. The tour is canceled. I have been reassigned to a weather station in Iceland, and I do not know or care what is to become of your sorry ass." They sent me to Fort Dix after that and assigned me to the steam heat company. All day and half the night I'd be shoveling coal into the boilers that keep the barracks warm. I'd be thinking a lot about my mama and about Bubba and the shrimp business and Jenny Curran up at Harvard. And I am playing a little ping-pong on the side. One day next spring, there's a notice that they is going to have a ping-pong tournament, and the winner will get to go to Washington to play for the All-Army Championship. I signed myself up, and it was pretty easy to win. Next week, I'm sent to Washington in the tournament, it being held at the Walter Reed Hospital, where all the wounded fellas can sit and watch us play. I won pretty easy in the first round and the second, too, but in the third I had drawn a little bitty fella who put all sorts of spin on the ball, and I am getting my ass whipped, when all of a sudden I look over in the crowd, and who should be sitting there in a wheelchair but Lieutenant Dan from the hospital back at Da Nang. We have a little break between games, and I go over to Dan and look down. He ain't got no legs no more. They have also taken off the bandages from his face, and he is terrible scarred from where his tank caught fire. Anyhow, he looked me in the eye and say, "Forrest, I believe that you can do any damn thing you want to. You can beat this little guy because you play a hell of a game of ping-pong, and it is your destiny to be the best." After that, I did not lose a single point, and I go on to the finals and win the whole tournament. I was there for about 3 days, and Dan and me got to spend some time together, and then I go back to shoveling coal. One day a fellow from the Pentagon showed up with a chest full of medals and a big smile, and he say, "PFC Gump, it is my pleasure to inform you that you has been chosen as a member of the United States ping pong team to go to Red China. This is a special honor, because for the first time in nearly 25 years our country is having anything to do with the Chinamen, and the future of the human race might be at stake. I am just a poor old idiot, and now I have got the whole human race to look after." Here I am, halfway around the world again, this time in Peking, China. The other people that play on the ping-pong team are real nice fellas, and the Chinaman is nice, too. They is very different sorts of gooks from what I've seen in Vietnam. First off, they is neat and clean and very polite. Second, they is not trying to murder me. Anyway, we is playing a whole lot of matches against the Chinaman, and they has got some very good players, but we is holding our own. One day, they take us way out of town to a big river, and there's a lot of Chinamen standing around looking official, because the head Chinaman of them all, Chairman Mao, is there. Chairman Mao is a big old fat Buddha-looking guy, and he has taken off his pajamas and is in his swimming trunks. And they says Chairman Mao, at the age of 80, is going to swim this river by himself. Well, the Chairman, he wade on in and start swimming, and folks is taking pictures, and all them other Chinamen be chattering away and looking pleased. He is about halfway across the river when he stop and raise his hand and wave at us. Everybody wave back. About a minute later, he wave again. Everybody wave back. Not too long after that, Chairman Mao wave for a third time, and suddenly it begun to dawn on everybody that he is not waving, he is drowning. Well, the shit done hit the fan. People is jumping in the water, and boats is racing out, and everybody is crying and leaping up and down. I say, "To hell with this. because I saw where he went under, and I throwed off my shoes, and into the river I went. I passed all the Chinamen who was swimming out there and got to the place where Chairman Mao had gone under. I dived down 3 or 4 times, and sure enough, I bumped into the old bastard floating around underwater. I hauled him up, and some Chinamen grabbed him and throwed him in the boat and took off so's I've got to swim back all the way by myself. When I get to the bank, all the people picked me up and carried me on their shoulders to the bus. But when we was on the road again, a State Department guy come up to me, and he's shaking his head. "You big dumb goof, do you not realize the best thing that could have happened for the United States was to let that sumbit drown? You, Gump, has just lost us the opportunity of a lifetime." So, I guess I done screwed up again. I don't know. I am still just trying to do the right thing. We is about through with the ping-pong games, and I have lost count of who is winning or losing. But what has happened in the meanwhile is that on account of my pulling old Chairman Mao out of the river, I have become a sort of a national hero to the Chinamen. The State Department guy says, "Gump, your stupidity seems to have turned into an advantage. The Chinese would like to start discussions about the possibility of reopening foreign relations with us. Furthermore, the Chinese wish to throw you a big parade." They held the parade 2 days later, and there was about 1 billion Chinamen along the streets, and they was waving and bowing and all when I went by. I am supposed to get thanked by Chairman Mao personally. When we get there, the chairman is all dried out and glad to see me. They has put on a big spread for lunch, and I get to sit next to the chairman himself. In the middle of the lunch, he lean over and say, "I have heard you was in Vietnam. May I ask what you think of the war?" An interpreter translate that for me, and I think about it for a moment, but then I figure, what the hell? He didn't want to know, he wouldn't have asked. I think it's a bunch of shit. The interpreter translate that back to him, and old Chairman Mao got a hard expression on his face. And then his eyes light up, and he break out with a big smile and start shaking my hand and nodding his head like one of them little dolls. People took pictures of that, and afterwards they was in the American newspapers. And I ain't never told nobody till now what I said to make him smile that way. After that, I am told they is letting me out of the army early. It don't take but a day or so, and then I'm gone. I have Jenny's letter with the name of the little place where she said she was playing with her band, the Ho Daddy Club. So I buy a ticket to Boston, and I go there. Directly, the place begun to fill up. They was mostly college-looking kids, but everybody wearing dirty blue jeans and T-shirts. Presently, the band come out on stage and start setting up all this huge electric stuff. It is certainly a far cry from what we'd done in the student union building back at the university. Also, I do not see Jenny Kerr in no place. After they get the electric stuff set up, they start to play. And let me say this, them people was loud. All sorts of colored lights began to flash, and the music sounded sort of like a jet airplane taking off. But the crowd be loving it, and when they is done, everybody begun to yell and cheer. Then a light fall on the side of the stage, and there she is, Jenny herself. She has got hair down to her ass, and is wearing sunglasses inside, at night. She is dressed in blue jeans and a shirt with so many spangles on it she looks like a telephone switchboard. The band start up again, and Jenny begun to sing. She has grabbed a hold of a microphone and is dancing all around the stage, jumping up and down, waving her arms and tossing her hair around. I am trying to understand the words to the song, but the band is playing too loud for that. It seemed like the roof going to cave in. I am thinking, what in hell is this? Anyway, after a while, I got bored and went out around to the back of the club. I sat down on some steps and got out my harmonica and started to play a little, sort of half out of key so it would fit in with what they was playing. It didn't take much before I was able to make runs of my own, and to my surprise it didn't sound half bad when you was playing it, so long as you didn't have to listen to it. All of a sudden, the door behind me bust open, and there is Jenny standing there. I guess they had taken their break again, but I wasn't paying no attention, and had kept on playing. "Who is that out there?" "It's me, Forrest." "Forrest? Forrest Gump?" And suddenly, she rushed out and throwed herself into my arms. Jenny and me, we sat around backstage and caught up on things till she had to play her next set. A banjo player had run off to Canada rather than to go into the Army, and the little band had broke up. Jenny had gone out to California for a while and wed flowers in her hair, but she say them people is a bunch of freaks who is stoned all the time. And so she met this guy and come up with him to Boston, and they had done some peace marches and all. He turned out to be a fairy, so she split up with him. She fell in with a band called the Cracked Eggs, and they started playing a new kind of music and got real popular around Boston. She says she is seeing this guy that goes to Harvard University and is a student in philosophy, but that after the show tonight, I can come and stay with him. I am very disappointed that she has got herself a boyfriend, but I don't have no place else to go, so that's what I done. When we get to their apartment, a little guy with hair like a dust mop and a lot of beads is sitting on the floor, meditating. Jenny say, "Rudolph, this is Forrest. He is a friend of mine from home, and he is going to be staying with us a while." Rudolph don't say nothing, but he wave his hand like the Pope when he is blessing something. Jenny made up a little pallet for me on the floor, and the next morning, there's Rudolph, still sitting in the middle of the room. Jenny fixed me some breakfast and took me on a tour of Cambridge. First thing, she says, is that I have got to get myself some new clothes, on account of people up here do not understand my uniform and will think I'm trying to put them on. So I get me some overalls and a lumber jacket and take my uniform in a paper bag. We gone on back to the apartment, and Rudolph is still squatting on the floor by himself. We was in the kitchen, and I asked her real quiet if Rudolph could talk, and she say, "Yes, sooner or later." That afternoon, Jenny took me to meet some other guys in the band, and she tell them I play the harmonica like heaven itself, and why don't they let me set in with them at the club tonight? So after that, I play with the Cracked Eggs every night. George, the guy who plays keyboard, has been teaching me a little bit of how to play it, and Mose, the drummer, has also let me beat on his drums some. It is kind of fun learning how to play all them things, and my harmonica, too. Then one afternoon I come home, and there is Jenny sitting by herself on the couch. I asked her, "Where is Rudolph?" And she say, "He has split." I asked her, "What for?" And she say, "'Cause he is a no-good bastard like all the rest." And so I says, "Why don't we go out and get ourselves some supper and talk about it?" Naturally, she does most of the talking, and it is really just a string of gripes about men. She say we are lazy, unresponsible, selfish, low-down, lying shits. She is going on that way for a while, and then she start to cry. "Oh, Jenny, don't do that. That old Rudolph didn't look like the kind of fella for you know-how." "Yes, Forrest, you is probably right. I'd like to go home now." And that was the night Jenny and me made love for the first time. When we is finished, Jenny just lie there a while, and she look at me and say, "God damn, Forrest, where has you been all my life?" Later, we is walking around Harvard University, and who does Jenny run into but a married professor she used to date. She is still friends with him, even though in private she liked to refer to him as a degenerate turd. Dr. Quackenbush is his name. Anyway, he is all excited on account of he is beginning to teach a new course next week that he thunk up all by himself. It is called The Role of the Idiot in World Literature. I pipe up and say, "I think that sounds pretty interesting." And he say, "Well, Forrest, why don't you sit in on the class? You might enjoy it." That next Monday, I have decided to go ahead and sit in on Dr. Quackenbush's class, Role of the Idiot in World Literature. The title alone is enough to make me feel sort of important. Dr. Quackenbush say, "The object of having a fool for most writers is to employ the device of double entendre, permitting them to let the fool make a fool of himself, and at the same time allow the reader the revelation of the greater meaning of the foolishness. Occasionally, a great writer like Shakespeare would let the fool make an ass out of one of his principal characters, thereby providing a twist for the reader's enlightenment." At this point, I am becoming somewhat confused, but that is normal. Anyhow, Mr. Quackenbush say that to demonstrate what he has been talking about, we is going to do a scene from the play King Lear, where there is a fool and a madman in disguise, and the king himself is crazy. He tells this guy named Elmer Harrington III to play the part of crazy old King Lear, and for this girl called Lucille to play the fool. Another guy called Horace somebody was to be Mad Tom of Bedlam. And then he say, "Forrest, why don't you play the role of the Earl of Gloucester?" Mr. Quackenbush say he will get a few stage spots from the drama department, but he want us to get up our own costumes, just so the thing would be more realistic. How I got into this deal, I do not know. The day finally arrived when we is to give our little play in Professor Quackenbush's class at Harvard. The scene we is to do is when King Lear and his fool go out onto the heath, which is like a marsh or a field back home, and a big storm done blowed up, and everybody run back into a shack called a hovel. Inside the hovel, there is a guy called Mad Tom of Bedlam, who is actually a character named of Edgar, disguised up as a crazy person on account of being fucked over by his brother, who is a bastard. Also, the king has done gone totally nuts by this time, and Edgar is playing a nut too, and a fool, of course, is acting like one. My part is to be the Earl of Gloucester, who is Edgar's father, and sort of a straight man for their mother's stooges. Professor Quackenbush have rigged up an old blanket or something to resemble a hovel, and he has got some kind of wind machine to sound like a storm. Big electric fan with clothespins holding pieces of paper to the blades. Anyway, here come Elmer Harrington III as King Lear, dressed in a gunny sack and wearing a colander on his head. The girl they got to play the fool has found a fool's costume someplace, with a little cap that had bells tied to it and them kinds of shoes that curl up in front, like Arabs wear. The guy playing Tom of Bedlam has found himself a beetle wig and some clothes out of the garbage and has painted his face with dirt. They is all taking it very seriously. I am probably the best looking of the bunch, though, because Jenny done sat down and sewed me up a costume out of a sheet and a pillowcase that I am wearing like a diaper, and she has also made me a cape out of a tablecloth, just like Superman wears. Anyway, Professor Quackenbush start up his wind machine and say for us to begin at page 12, where Mad Tom is telling us his sad story. "Do poor Tom some charity, whom the foul fiend vexes." And King Lear say, "What? Have his daughters brought him to this pass? Couldst thou save nothing? Didst thou give them all?" And the fools say, "Nay, he reserved a blanket, else we had all been shamed." This shit go on for a while, and then the fools say, "This cold night will turn us all into fools and madmen." In this, the fool is correct. Just about this time, I am supposed to enter into the hovel, carrying a torch, which Professor Quackenbush have borrowed from the drama department. The fool call out, "Look, here come a walking fire." Professor Quackenbush light my torch, and I go across the room into the hovel. Tom of Bedlam say, "This is the foul fiend, Flibbertigibbet." And the king acts, "What's he?" And I say, "What are you there? Your names?" Mad Tom say he is just poor Tom that eats the swimming frog, the toad, the tadpole, and the newt, and a bunch of other shit. And then I suppose to suddenly recognize the king and say, "What, hath your grace no better company?" And Mad Tom, he answer, "The Prince of Darkness is a gentleman, Modo he's called, and Mayhew." The wind machine be blowing hard now, and I reckon Professor Quackenbush have not considered that I am 6 feet 6 inches tall when he built the hovel, because the top of my torch is bumping against the ceiling. Mad Tom, he is now supposed to say, "Poor Tom's a cold." But instead he say, "Watch that torch." I look down at my book to see where that line come from, and Elmer Harrington III say to me, "Look out for that torch, you idiot." And I say back to him, "For once in my life, I am not the idiot. You is." And then all of a sudden the roof to the hovel catch on fire and fall on Mad Tom's beetle wig and set it on fire too. Somebody shout, "Turn off the goddamn wind machine." But it is too late. Everything burning up. Mad Tom is hollering and yelling, and King Lear take off his colander and jam it on Mad Tom's head to put the fire out. People is jumping around and choking and coughing and cussing, and a girl playing the fool gets hysterical and commenced to shriek and cry, "We will all be killed!" For a moment or two, it actually looks that way. I turn behind me, and damn if my cape ain't caught on fire. And so I throwed open the window and grabbed the fool around her waist, and out we leaped. It was only from the second-story window, and they was a bunch of shrubs down there that broke our fall. But it was also lunchtime, and hundreds of people was wandering around the yard. There we was, all afire and smoldering. Black smoke come pouring from up in the open window of the class, and all of a sudden there's Professor Quackenbush leaning out and looking around, shaking his fist, face all covered up with soot. "Gump, you fucking idiot, you stupid asshole, you will pay for this." The fool is groveling around on the ground, bawling and wringing her hands, but saying she's okay, just singed up a bit. So I just took off, bounded across the yard as fast as I could run, cape still on fire, smoke trailing behind me. I didn't stop till I got home, and when I get into the apartment, Jenny say, "Oh, Forrest, how was it? I bet you was wonderful." Then she get a peculiar look on her face. "Say, do you smell something burning?" It's a long story. Every night, I and Jenny are playing with the cracked eggs, and all day long we is making love and taking walks and having picnics, and it is heaven. It were a splendid spring and summer. It is like my whole life just begun, and I am the happiest feller in the world. One night, Mose, the drummer, take me aside. "Forrest, you is a nice clean-cut feller and all, but there's something I want you to try that I think will make you play that harmonica better." He give me a little cigarette. I tell him I don't smoke, but thanks. It is not a regular cigarette, Forrest. It have got something in it to expand your horizons. Well, let me say this. My horizons indeed become expanded. Everything seemed to slow down and get rosy keen. That second set we played that night was the best of my life. I seemed to hear all the notes 100 times as I was playing them, and Mose come up to me later and say, "Forrest, you think that's good? Use it when you're screwing." I did. And he was right about that, too. Before you know it, I was using that stuff day in and day out. The only problem was, it kind of made me stupider after a while. I just get up in the morning and light one of them joints and lie there all day until it was time to go and play. Jenny didn't say nothing for a while because she'd been known to take a puff or two herself. But then one day she say to me, "Forrest, don't you think you've been doing too much of that shit?" "I don't know. How much is too much?" "As much as you're doing is too much." But I didn't want to stop. Well, one night I go on outside to light up a joint, and I'm sitting there minding my business when these two girls come up. One of them say, "Hey, ain't you the harmonica player with the cracked eggs?" I nod, and she just plop herself down in my lap. The other girl is grinning and squealing, and suddenly she take off her blouse. And the other girl is trying to unzip my pants and have her skirt pulled up, and I'm just sitting there blowed away, and suddenly the stage door opened, and Jenny called out, "Forrest, it's time to..." And she stopped for a second, and then she say, "Oh, shit," and slammed the door. I jumped up then, and the girl in my lap fell on the ground, and the other one is cussing it all, but I went inside, and there's Jenny leaned up against the wall crying. She say, "Keep away from me, you shithead. You men is all alike, just like dogs or something. You got no respect for anybody." I ain't never felt so bad. That night, Jenny slept on the sofa, and the next morning, she say, "Maybe it is time for me to find my own place." And so I packed up my shit and left. Couldn't explain it to her or nothing. Later, I hear that Jenny is down in Washington, marching against the Vietnam War. And Mose says she is probably staying with this group from Boston that has taken an apartment in Washington. So that is where I go. So I find Jenny and I start telling her how sorry I am about what's happened. I tell her I ain't going to smoke dope no more, nor play in the band no more on account of all the bad temptations. We sat and talked for a while, and then them other people she's staying with is all discussing a big demonstration tomorrow at the U.S. Capitol, at which a bunch of Vietnam veterans is going to take off their medals and throw them on the steps of the Capitol. And Jenny suddenly say, "Do you know Forrest here done won the Congressional Medal of Honor?" And everybody get completely quiet and be looking at me. Well, the next morning, Jenny come in the living room where I was sleeping and say, "Forrest, I want you to go with us today, and I want you to wear your Army uniform. You was going to do something to stop all the suffering over in Vietnam." It is a bright and clear day, and when we get to the Capitol, there is a mob there with TV cameras and all the police in the world. Everybody be chanting and hollering and giving the finger to the police. Some other guys in Army uniforms is there, and one by one, they commence to walk as close as they can get to the steps of the Capitol, and they took off their medals and throwed them. Some of them just tossed their medals onto the steps, but others really throwed them hard. Somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "It is my turn now." It gets sort of quiet. Then somebody on a bullhorn announced my name and say, "I is going to throw away the Congressional Medal of Honor as a token of my support for ending the Vietnam War." Everybody cheer and clap, and I can see the other medals lying there on the steps. High up on the porch of the Capitol is a couple of cops and some guys in suits. I take off my medal and look at it for a second. I be remembering Bubba and all and Dan and I don't know. Something come over me, but I got to throw it. So I rear back and heave that medal hard as I can. A couple of seconds later, one of the guys on the porch that is wearing a suit, he just keel over. Unfortunately, I done throw the medal too far and knock him in the head with it. All hell break loose then. Police be charging into the crowd and people be shouting and tear gas bust open, and next thing you know, I am handcuffed and thrown into a police wagon and hauled off to jail. In the morning, they take me in front of a judge. "Mr. Gump, do you realize that you have conked the clerk of the U.S. Senate on the head with your medal? I do not know what a man who has served his country so well is doing mixed up with a bunch of tutti-frutti's that is throwing away their medals. So I is going to order you committed for psychiatric observation for 30 days. Finally, I am put away. This place is a serious loony bin. The second day I am there, my psychiatrist, Dr. Walton, she starts showing me cards with ink blots on them, asking me what I thought they were. I kept on saying ink blot till she finally get mad and tell me I got to say something else. So I started making things up. A couple of days later, Dr. Walton and two other doctors give me some more tests. They is a lot more complicated, but I figure I done okay. Had I known what was going to happen next, I would have fucked them up. One doctor say, "You has got a brain just like a computer, though I do not know how well you can reason with it." The other one, Dr. Duke, say, "I think we ought to send him down to the Aeronautics and Space Center. They has been looking for just this sort of fellow." They flown me down to Houston, Texas, in a big old plane with nobody on it but me and Dr. Duke. It is a pleasant sort of trip, except they got me chained to my seat, hand and foot. Dr. Duke say, "Look a here, Forrest. Right now you is in a shit pot of trouble for throwing that medal at the clerk of the U.S. Senate. You can go to jail for 10 years for that. But if you cooperates with these people at NASA, I will personally see to it that you is released. Okay?" After I am at the NASA place for about a month, they tell me what they has in mind. "Gump, we wants to use you on a flight to outer space. Your mind is just like a computer, only better. If we can program it with the right stuff, you will be extremely useful to America's space program." They has already shot people up to the moon, but they didn't find nothing there worth a shit, so what they is planning next is a visit to Mars. Fortunately for me, this is to be sort of a training mission in which they is going to try to figure out what kind of folks would be suited best for the Mars trip. Besides me, they has picked a woman and an ape to go along. The woman is a crabby-looking lady called Major Janet Fritch. She is a sort of short lady with hair like a bowl, and she don't seem to have much use for either me or the ape. The ape ain't so bad, actually. It is a big old female orangutan called Sue. Actually, they has got a whole bunch of them apes down here and have been shooting them up into space for a long while. But they says Sue will be best on this trip on account of she is a female and will be friendlier than a male ape. And also, this will be her third space flight. When I find this out, I'm wondering how come they're going to send us way up there with the only experienced crew member being an ape. Kind of makes you think, don't it? Well, the big day finally come. They get us into our spacesuits and take us out there to the launching pad in a little bus. The spaceship is about 100 stories tall and is all foaming and hissing and steaming and look like it's about to eat us alive. An elevator take us up to the capsule we is to be in, and they strap us all in. Then we wait. And we wait some more. About noon, somebody come up and knock on the spaceship door and say, "We is temporarily canceling this space mission until we get the spaceship fixed." So we all get to go back down in the elevator again. About an hour later, somebody run into where we is just about to have our lunch. "Get in your spacesuits again right away. They is fixing to shoot you up in space." We is halfway up the elevator when somebody suddenly say, "Jesus, we forgot the goddamn ape." Major Fritch and me is strapped in again, and somebody is counting backwards from 100 when they come through the door with Sue. The count is down to about 10 when I be hearing some strange growling noises behind us. And lo and behold, it ain't Sue sitting there at all. It is a big old male ape. Major Fritch, she called the ground control tower, but all of a sudden the spaceship starts to rumbling and quaking, and the guy in the ground control tower says, "That's your problem now, sister. We got a schedule to meet." And away we go. My first impression is of being squashed under something, such as my daddy was when them bananas fell on him. But after a little while, things ease up. Major Fritch say we can unbuckle our seatbelts now. She say we is now traveling at a speed of 15,000 miles an hour. I look back, and sure enough, the Earth is only a little ball behind us. Actually, after you get used to it, being in outer space is kind of fun. We can float all over the spaceship, and the scenery is remarkable. Moon and sun, Earth and stars. Day and night go by every hour or so, and so it sort of put a different perspective on things. I wonder where Jenny Curran is down there and what she's doing. Big old ape is glaring at us, and Major Fritch say for me to give him a banana before he gets angry and does something bad. He grabbed the banana and start mushing it up and flinging the mush every place, and I got to clean it up. Wants attention all the time, too. Every time you leave him alone, he commences to put up an enormous racket. Finally, I got out my harmonica and started playing Home on the Range. The ape calmed down a little bit. Anyhow, things are going along pretty good, but I've been noticing that this new Sue has got something in mind. Ain't long before I found out what it is. I have gone behind this little partition to take a pee in a jar in private when all of a sudden I hear this commotion. Then it dawns on me that while we has been up here in space for nearly 2 days, old Sue has been strapped into his seat. He ain't had a chance to take a leak or nothing. And I sure remember what that's like. He must be about to bust. I unstrap Sue and take him behind the partition to find an empty bottle for him to pee in. After he finished, he take the bottle and heave it into a panel of colored lights, and it bust to pieces, and all the pee started floating around. I start leading Sue back to his seat when I seen a big old glob of pee heading straight for Major Fritch. So I turned Sue loose and tried to head off the pee with a net they have given us. But just as I am about to net the glob of pee, Major Fritch turned around and it caught her right in the face. In the meantime, Sue has done gone and started ripping out wires from the control panel. Major Fritch is screaming, "Stop him! Stop him!" But before you know it, sparks and stuff is flying all around, and Sue is jumping from ceiling to floor, tearing shit up. The spaceship is going end over end, and me, Sue, and Major Fritch is tossed around like corks. Ground control say, "We is noticing some kind of minor stabilization trouble with your craft." I manage to glance out of the window, and in fact, things don't look good. The Earth coming up on us mighty fast. Then everything gets scorching hot, and funny little sounds are coming from the outside of the spaceship, and it starts shaking and hissing, and the Earth is dead up ahead. But then, all of a sudden, something go pop, and the spaceship slow down. Damn if old Sue ain't pulled a parachute lever and saved our asses. It looked like we was going to hit a great big old green blob of land, which apparently ain't so good since we supposed to only hit water. Major Fritch look out the window, and she say, "Jesus, this looked like Borneo or someplace." But when she try to tell that to ground control, the radio done gone dead. We be getting real close to the Earth now, and the spaceship's still swinging under the parachute. There is nothing but jungle and mountains beneath us, except for a little bitty lake. We can barely make out something going on next to the lake, and all of a sudden, Major Fritz cry out, "Good God, this ain't Borneo. This is fucking New Guinea. They has got a landing zone all marked off with them big brown black markers." Them things look more like cooking pots to me. "Yeah, they do, sort of," she say. "Ain't this where cannibals come from?" "I reckon we will soon find out," says Major Fritz. Our landing in the little lake was not too bad. There was a splash and a bounce, and then we was back on Earth again. Everything got real quiet, and me and Sue and Major Fritz peek out the window. A whole tribe of the fiercest-looking folks imaginable is standing about 10 feet away on the shore. They is wearing little grass skirts, and has their hair all flayed out, and some is carrying shields and spears. Then 7 or 8 of them biggest fellas, they jumps into the water and begin pushing us over to land. Then there is a big knock at the door of the spaceship. "Don't nobody do nothing," say Major Fritz. But old Sue, he go over and open up the door. Standing there is this big guy with a bone through his nose and a lot of beads around his neck. The fella fall over on his face and begun bowing and scraping. And then, out from the bushes come the rest of them, moving slow and scared-like, ready to throw their spears. The fella on the ground stopped bowing for a moment, and he holler out something, and they put their spears down and come up to the spaceship and gather around it. Major Fritz say, "They look friendly enough now. I suppose we better go out and identify ourselves. The people from NASA will be here in a few minutes to pick us up." As it turns out, that is the biggest piece of bullshit I have ever heard in my life, before or since. Anyhow, we walk on out. The big old boy stand up. "Hello, me good boy, who you?" And he stick out his hand. I shake his hand, but Major Fritz say, "We is participants in the NASA Multi-Orbital Preplanetary Subgravitational Interspheroid Spaceflight Training Mission." The fella just stand there, gaping at us like we was spacemen. And so I says, "We is Americans." His eyes light up. "Do tell, Americans, what a jolly fine show, I say. I've been to America during the war. I was recruited to learn English and then sent back here to organize our people in guerrilla warfare against the Japanese." "Where'd you go to school?" "Why, I went to Yale, old sport. Bula Bula and all that. My name is Sam. At least that's what they call me at Yale. My real name's quite a mouthful. What a delight you dropped in. Would you like some tea?" "Yeah, that'd be good." Big Sam wave his hands, and the drums start up again, and we'd be escorted into the jungle with everybody chanting, "Bula, bula, bula." They has got theyselves a little village set up out in the jungle, with grass huts and shit, just like in the movies, and Big Sam's hut is the grandest. Out in front he got a chair look like a throne, and 4 or 5 women wearing nothing on top of doing whatever he say. He say for one of them to come and get us some tea and a banana for Sue, and we sat down on a couple of big stones. "I'm awfully sorry. I think I haven't asked your names." "Major Janet Fritz, United States Air Force, serial number 0453-4573. That's all I'm going to tell you." "Oh, my dear woman, you are not a prisoner here. We mean you no harm. And what of you, young man?" "My name is Forrest." "And where did you go to school?" I start to say that I went up to the University of Alabama for a while, but then I decided to play it safe, and so I told him I went to Harvard. "Ah, Harvard, lovely bunch of fellows, even if they couldn't get into Yale." He start to laugh real loud. "Actually, you do look sort of like a Harvard man at that." Somehow I figured that trouble lay ahead. All night long, them natives be beating on their drums and chanting "Bula Bula," and we could see from our grass hut that they have set up a great big cauldron and built a fire under it. Next morning, Big Sam say, "Hello, did you have a nice sleep?" Major Fritz say, "How in God's name did you expect us to sleep with all that racket out there?" Big Sam get a pained look on his face. "Oh, I'm so sorry about that, But you see, my people were, actually expecting a gift of some sort. When they saw that you had no presents, naturally they assumed that you were the present. And they were prepared to cook and eat you until I persuaded them otherwise. That's disgusting, say Major Fritch. I demand that we be set free this instant and be allowed to make our way to the nearest telephone. You see, I'm afraid that would be impossible. Even if we did turn you loose, the pygmies would get you. We have been at war with the pygmies for many generations. Well, I'd rather us take our chances with pygmies than a bunch of fucking cannibals. The pygmies ain't cannibals, is they? No, madam, they are headhunters. But to appease my people, I think that while you are here, you could perhaps do some work for us. What sort of work? Well, farming work, actually. I think that if we can bring to our fertile soil the modern techniques of agronomy, we might thus begin to haul ourselves out of our tribal predicament and assume a role in the world marketplace. What kind of farming? Cotton, my dear woman, cotton, king of cash crops. You expecting us to grow cotton? You bet your sweet arse I do, sister. Well, here we is, planting cotton, all up and down the whole creation. If we ever get our asses out of here, I don't never want to be no cotton farmer. We has convinced Big Sam not to give poor old Sue to his tribe to eat, and every day there's old Sue out there with us, wearing a big straw hat. And another thing done happened. About the third or fourth week we was there, Big Sam says, "Look here, Forrest, old boy, do you play chess?" And I says, "No." And he say, "Well, you're a Harvard man. You might like to learn." First few days, he taught me strategy, but after that he quit doing it because I beat him a game or two. After a while, the games get longer. Sometimes they last for several days, but I always manage to beat him. One day he say, "You know, Forrest, I'm surely glad you've come here so I can have somebody to play chess with, and I am glad that I have saved you from that cooking pot. The only thing is, I really would just like to win one chess game from you." At that, Big Sam be licking his chops, and it didn't take no idiot to figure out that if I let him win just one game, he was going to be satisfied and have me for his supper. Kind of kept me on my toes, if you know what I mean. Meantime, a very strange thing has happened with Major Fritch. One day we is walking back from the cotton fields, when a big old black arm poke out from a clump of bushes and beckon her over. Me and Sue stopped, and Major Fritch walk over and say, "Who is that in there?" All of a sudden, the big old arm reach out and grab the hold of Major Fritch and snatch her into the bush. I was about to leap into the bushes myself, and Sue starts shaking his head and waving me away. The bushes is shaking like crazy, and I finally figured out what was going on, but from the sound of Major Fritch's voice, it didn't appear she was in no danger or nothing. So Sue and me went on back to the village. About an hour later, here come Major Fritch and this great big old fellow who is grinning ear to ear. She has got him by the hand and bring him into our hovel and say, "Forrest, I want you to meet Gurk." Gurk done asked me to move in with him, and I think I will, since it is sort of crowded in here for the three of us. The days and months and finally the years come and go, and every day me and Sue and Major Fritch be working in the cotton fields. At night, after I finish whipping Big Sam at chess, I go into the hovel with old Sue and we sit around for a while. It has got to where Sue and me can sort of talk to each other, grunting and making faces and waving our hands. The cotton farming adventure is beyond anyone's wildest dreams, and Big Sam has just about finished the river barge that is to take us through pygmy country to the town. The night before we is to leave, they hold a big hoedown to celebrate everything and also ward off evil spirits. All the tribe be sitting around the fire, chanting "Bula Bula" and beating on their drums. They has also drug out that big cauldron and got it on the fire steaming and boiling. But Big Sam say it is only a symbolic gesture. We are sitting there playing chess, and I am so excited I'm about to bust. Just let us get near a town, and we is long gone. We has played one or two games and is about to finish another when I suddenly look down and damned if old Big Sam ain't got me in check. While I've been assing around counting my chickens before they're hatched, I have put myself in an impossible position on the chessboard. There ain't no way out. I studied that thing for a while, and then I says, I got to pee. Big Sam nods, still grinning. I went on behind the hovel and took a pee, but then I went in and got old Sue and explained to him what the deal was. Then I snuck up on Grook's hut and whispered for Major Fritch. Grook, he say he's coming with us. The four of us started creeping out of the village, and we was just about to get into one of the canoes when all of a sudden I look up and there's Big Sam with about 1,000 of his natives. Come now, old sport. Did you really think you could outsmart this old devil? Oh, we was just going for a canoe ride in the moonlight. Then his men grabbed us up and hauled us back to the village. The cooking cauldron is bubbling and steaming to beat the band, and the outlook is something less than rosy. Well, old sport, I must tell you this. You are without a doubt the best chess player I have ever encountered, and I was the chess champion of Yale for 3 years. And now, let the feast begin. They lifted up poor old Sue first and was about to throw him in, when lo and behold, an arrow come out of no place and strike one of the fellows hoisting up Sue. The fellow fall down, and Sue drop on top of him. Then, more arrows come raining down on us from the edge of the jungle, and everybody is in a panic. It's the pygmies! Get to your arms! Major Fritch, me and Sue and Gurk start running down toward the river, but we ain't no more than 10 feet down a path when all of a sudden we is snatched up feet first by some kind of snare set in the trees, and we is hanging there upside down like bats. All sorts of savage sounds are coming from the village, but after a while, everything quiet down. Then a bunch of pygmies come and cut us down, and tie our hands and feet and take us back to the village. It is a sight. They has captured Big Sam and all his natives and has them tied up hand and foot, too. Look like they is about to throw them into the boiling pot. Well, old sport, seems like you were saved in the nick of time, doesn't it? Tell you what, though, looks like it's all over for me and my fellas, but maybe you still have a chance. If you can get to that harmonica of yours and play a little tune or two, it might save your life. The king of the pygmies is crazy for American music. When we come to the pygmy village, one little old fellow with a long white beard be sitting up in a high chair. I figure him to be the king. They tumped us onto the ground and untied us, and we stood up and dusted ourselves off, and the king started talking some gibberish, Pygmalion or whatever. And Grook say, him want to know why you living with them awful cannibals. I got an idea, I says. Tell him we is American musicians. Grook say this to the king, and the king announced he want to hear us perform. I get out my harmonica and started playing Camptown Races. King listened for a minute, then he start clapping his hands and doing what looked to be a clog dance. After I'm finished, he want to know what the others play. And I tell Grook to say Sue plays the spears, and Major Fritch plays the knives, and that Grook don't play nothing. He is the manager. King looked sort of puzzled, but he tell his men to give Sue some spears and Major Fritch some knives, and let's see what sort of music we can come up with. I say, okay, now. And old Sue conked the king over the head with his spear, and Major Fritch threatened a couple of the pygmies with her knives, and we run off into the jungle with the pygmies in hot pursuit. The pygmies be throwing all sorts of rocks and shit at us and shooting their bows and arrows and darts and blowguns and such. Suddenly, we come out on the bank of a river. Ain't no place to go, but the pygmies are catching up fast. We is about to jump into the river and swim for it, when suddenly from the opposite side of the river, a rifle shot rang out, and then another, and the pygmies run back into the jungle. Lo and behold, on the other bank there is a couple of fellas wearing bush jackets and white pith helmets with NASA stamped on them. They step into a canoe and be paddling toward us, and we is at last saved from a fate worse than death. We is going down river, and after a while Major Fritch suddenly call out, "Stop the canoe! I have made a decision. For the first time in my life I have found a man that truly understands me, and I'm not going to let him go. We will make a new life for ourselves and raise a family and live happily ever after." And she and Grook get out of the canoe and start back into the jungle, hand in hand. I look at old Sue, and he is sitting there twisting his fingers. I go on back and sit down next to him and say, "What are you thinking about?" He grabbed me around the shoulders in a big hug and then leaped out of the boat. Last we seen of him, he is swinging away through the jungle on a vine. They flown me back to America, to Washington, and said they was taking me to see the president. I'm expecting to see the same old president what fed me breakfast, but they has got a new president now. Fellow with his hair all slicked back, puffy little cheeks, and a nose looked like Pinocchio's. Tell me now, did you have an exciting trip? A fellow in a suit standing next to the president leaned over and whispered something to him, and suddenly the president starts stammering. Actually what I meant was, how great it is that you have escaped from your ordeal in the jungle. Now he'd be looking at a little card in his hand. Says here that even as you were being rescued, a Major Janet Fritz was dragged off into the jungle by a cannibal. That's not so. Now you look here. I am your commander-in-chief. I am not a crook. I do not lie. Well, I'm very sorry, but it ain't the truth. You just take that off that card, but... Tape! No, he said take, not tape, Mr. President. Tape? I told you never to mention that word in my presence. You're all a bunch of disloyal communist swines. I don't know anything about anything. I never heard of anything. If I did, I either forgot it or it is top secret. Then the president calmed down and pat me on the back. Look here. I have a meeting to go to. Why don't I walk you to the door? They had put me up in a hotel, but a day or so later, a couple of fellas come in and say, "Listen here, Gump, the free ride's over. You're on your own now." I ask for a little traveling money, but they shake their heads. Forget it. You was lucky not to be in jail for conking the clerk of the Senate. We got you off that rap, but we is washing our hands of your ass as of right now. It was raining cats and dogs, and I was walking along when I seen a big old plastic garbage bag sitting on a grate in the middle of the sidewalk. Just as I get close to it, the bag commenced to move a little bit, like there is something in there. I nudged the bag a little with my toe, and suddenly a voice come out from under it, say, "Get the fuck away from me." I say, "I'm just trying to get out of the rain." A fella's head peek out, squinting up at me like I'm some kind of idiot. He is pretty sorry-looking, ain't shaved in months, eyes all red. "Well," he say, "in that case, okay, here." He reach up and hand me another garbage bag, all folded up. What am I supposed to do with this? "Open it up and get under it, you damn fool. You said you wanted to get out of the rain." And then he pull his bag back down over himself. To tell you the truth, it wasn't so bad, really. There was some hot air coming up out of the grate, and it'd make the bag all cozy and warm inside and kept off the rain. We'd be squatting on the grate with the bags over us, and after a while the fella says to me, "What's your name, anyway?" "Forrest." "Yeah? I knew a guy named Forrest once. Long time ago." "What's your name?" "Dan." "Dan? Dan? Hey, wait a minute." I throwed off my garbage bag and lifted up the bag off the feller, and it was him, sitting on a little wood cart with roller skate wheels on the bottom. I could hardly recognize him, but it was old Lieutenant Dan. "Well, old pal, tell me what you've been doing since I saw you last," Dan said. And so I did. Next morning, Dan loaned me a dollar, and I called up to Boston to old Mose that used to be the drummer for the Cracked Eggs. Mose say that Jenny moved to Chicago, and then she got herself a job in a tire factory in Indianapolis. Dan say, "Why don't we take a bus? 'Cause he's got enough money for that." I felt bad about taking his money, but somehow I figured that he wanted to go. The bus left us off in the middle of Indianapolis, and about noon we see the big sign say Temper Tires, and figure this to be the place. There was a lot of folks come out, and then, all by herself, I seen Jenny walk out and go over to a little spot under a tree and pull a sandwich out of a paper bag. I went over and sort of creeped up behind her, and I says, "That sure looks like a tasty sandwich." She didn't even look up. She kept staring right ahead and say, "Forrest, it has to be you." Well, let me tell you, that was the happiest reunion of my life. Jenny is crying and hugging me, and I'm doing the same, and everybody else in retreads is standing there and wonder what in hell is going on. Jenny says she is off work in about 3 hours, and for me and Dan to go over to this little tavern across the street and have a beer or something and wait for her. Then she will take us to her place. Bunch of other fellas is in the tavern, too, playing darts and drinking and arm wrestling. One big old guy seemed to be the best arm wrestler, and every once in a while some fella would come up and try to beat him, but couldn't. They'd be betting on it, too, $5 and $10 a whack. After a little bit, Dan whisper, "Forrest, here's $5, 'cause I'm betting you can beat that big bozo over there at arm wrestling." So I go up and say to the fella, "Would you mind if I sat down and arm wrestle with you?" He'd look up at me, smiling. "Long as you got money, you is welcome to try." So I sat down, and we grabbed each other's hands, and somebody say, "Go." Other fella be grunting and straining like a dog trying to shit a peach seed, but in about 10 seconds I had smushed his arm down on the table. Well, he ain't none too happy, but he paid me the $5, and I went back and give Dan the money. Forrest, we may have found an easy way to make ourselves some bread. The three of us settled into Jenny's little apartment after that. Every morning she'd go off to the tire company, and Dan and me would sit around the house and talk and then go down to the tavern to wait till she got off. The guy I beat wanted a chance to get his $5 back, and I gave it to him. He tried 2 or 3 times more, and in the end lost about $25, and after that he didn't come back no more. But there was always some other fella wanting to try his luck, and after a month or two there was guys coming in from all over town and from other little towns, too. Dan and me, we was pulling in about $150 or $200 a week, which weren't bad, let me tell you. And the owner of the tavern, he is saying he's going to hold a national contest and get the TV there and everything. But before that happened, another thing come along that changed my life for sure. One day, a fella come into the tavern that was wearing a white suit and a Hawaiian shirt and a lot of gold jewelry around his neck. He sat up at the bar while I was finishing off some guy at arm wrestling, and then he come and sat down at that table. "Name's Mike, and I have heard about you. I think I got an idea how you can make a hell of a lot more money than this nickel and dime shit you're doing here." Dan says, "How's that?" "Wrestling. But not this pissant stuff. I mean the real thing. In a ring with hundreds of thousands of paying customers. There's a circuit of professional wrestlers. Top guys making $100,000, $200,000 a year. We'd start your boy off here slow, teach him some of the holds, show him the ropes. Why, I bet in no time he'd be a big star and make everybody a pile of money." Dan turned to me. "Listen, Forrest, some of what this fella say makes sense. I mean, how else are you going to earn enough money to start a shrimp business?" Well, that's how I become a professional wrestler. Jenny is not too keen on it, on account of she say I might get hurt. And when I say nobody gets hurt because it's all put on, she say, "Then what's the point of it?" It is a good question that I cannot rightly answer, but I am looking forward to making us some money. One day, they is trying to show me something called a belly flop on top of people, but somehow I keep screwing it up. Finally, Mike come in the ring and say, "Jesus, Forrest, you some kind of idiot or something. You could hurt somebody that way." "Yep, I am an idiot." Dan, he explained something to Mike, and Mike say, "Good God, is you kidding?" Anyway, about an hour later, Mike come running out of his office. "I've got it. The dunce. We will dress him up in diapers and put a big old dunce cap on his head. The crowd will love it." Dan think for a minute. "I don't know. I don't much like it. Sounds like you're trying to make a fool out of him." Mike say, "It's only for the crowd. He has to have a gimmick of some sort." "I still don't like it." Dan looks at me. "What you think, Forrest?" "I don't really give a shit." After all them months of training, Mike come into the gym one day with my diaper and a big old black dunce cap and say to be back to noon tomorrow so he can drive us to my first wrestling match. That night I gone into the bathroom and put on the diaper and the dunce cap and come out into the living room. "Forrest, what on earth?" It's his costume, Dan say. It makes you look like a fool. Dan explains. Look at it this way. It's like he's in a play or something. He still looks like a fool. I can't believe it. You let them dress him up like that and go out in public? I don't like